This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Back in 2008, David Mitchell watched with the rest of the country as Barack Obama became the first African-American to be elected president. David's friends were optimistic, but David was skeptical. He recognized that the election was certainly a historic moment, but he wondered if it would really change American politics. He soon got the chance to get into politics himself. His friend, Ken Lewis, was running for U.S. Senate in North Carolina in 2010, and he asked David to be his campaign manager. They both saw it as a chance to further the effects of the Obama presidency. They ultimately lost the Democratic primary. Afterward, David reflected more on how the race plays into the Democratic Party's platform and position here in the state of North Carolina. David channeled those experiences on the campaign trail into a new novel. It is called We Hold These Truths. David speaks Monday at the BU Cafe in Durham and Tuesday at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill. David Mitchell joins me now in the studio. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Frank. Good to be here.
Tell us more about this experience you had, this sense in the, at the end of the Obama the campaign, that maybe while it was a historic moment, you were a little more skeptical about what this meant ultimately.
Yeah, you know, I kind of looked back. I was a student of history, and I had been aware of so many instances in our country's history where we presumably met, you know, got to this zenith and found that we hadn't quite actually gotten there. And, you know, Ken and I were actually talking about this book throughout the period that I was writing in. And we one day while I was, you know, afternoon in my office in Deckard in Washington, D.C., came with this idea called the Demonstration Project, which I articulate as an American commitment to commit, right? But not to the underlying work and substance that's required to bring about the change. And so I argue that we see this, you know, in several places in U.S. history. We've seen it in the Declaration of Independence, right? We hold these truths to be self-evident, right? Obviously, that was not reflective of what was happening in our society. And I argue that 2008 was another example. We got interested, excited about this great idea, this great possibility, but we weren't actually committed. And I think 2010 is where that all played out, right? I also think that the presence of Barack Obama, you know, between then and now, kind of concealed some of the fractures within the Democratic Party. And it kind of explains why we weren't able to do the, make this kind of big progress in the off-cycle elections in 2010 and again in 2014.
Well, Ken Lewis is also with us now. He's a Durham-based attorney. He ran for the U.S. Senate in North Carolina in 2010, and he will be alongside you, David Mitchell, at the BU Cafe in Durham and Flyleaf Books to talk about this book. So welcome to the program, Ken. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me here.
Tell us more about this conversation that you were having. This is, it goes back to 2008, in your sense that America hadn't committed to being committed. Tell me more about that.
Well, I think we spend a lot of time thinking about politics since the 1965 Voting Rights Act. And a lot of that conversation centers around the Southern strategy. And that's a strategy we know attributed to Richard Nixon after African Americans received the right to vote in 1965. Nixon is said to say, we'll win the South now by focusing on dispossessed white voters. What we don't spend a lot of time talking about, and I think this is what I have, upon reflection, realized in looking back on 2010, we don't spend much time talking about or thinking about what was a Democratic response. And when you think about that, there is a very clear Democratic response, and I call it the grand strategy. And the Democratic grand strategy, really beginning in 1965, and I would argue even until today, is a simple formula. And that is, Democrats, through their candidates, through their messaging, through their policies, seek to attract the largest number of white voters possible. And then they turn to progressives and voters of color and seek to convince them that the Democratic candidate and message and policies are better than the Republican alternative, and that voters of color and progressives should then get out to vote. Barack Obama had a different strategy, and I think the real rub here is for Democrats to be intentional about whether or not they want to continue with this grand strategy, which I argue is no longer a winning strategy for Democrats, or adopt the Obama strategy.
Well, and it's possible that it was even more acutely drawn, that difference, in this last cycle when you have Bernie Sanders really articulating some serious values about changing the structures that underlie much of the inequality in this country. And, you know, everybody wrote him off.
Right. what's available to Democrats and progressives now that wasn't available in 1965 is what's called the New American Strategy. And the New American Strategy is made possible because of demographic changes since 1965. Today, progressives, whites, constitute 28% of the total electorate. And people of color, voters of color, constitute 23% of the electorate. That constitutes a new American majority. And the numbers in North Carolina are actually the same. Over 50% of the electorate in North Carolina are progressives, whites, and people of color. Barack Obama's strategy was to have a candidate and a campaign and a message based upon values, values of unity, of opportunity, and progress that appealed to that new American majority. And I submit that that should be the strategy of the Democratic Party going forward to win elections. And I think you're exactly right. Bernie Sanders' message also was geared toward that new American majority.
Talk about your decision then in 2010 to apply the test and to put that theory to the test. Tell me more about that decision to run.
So I got very involved in the Obama campaign early on. I'd gone to law school with Michelle Obama. I'd raised money for Senator Obama when he ran for the U.S. Senate. So I got very involved early on in the race. And what I saw was a candidate that appealed to values, hopes, and dreams. And I saw that candidate start a race when no one expected that he could win. And not only did he win the presidency, but he won North Carolina. After that race, I began to think about what this meant for politics in the future. There was an upcoming U.S. Senate race, and I began, frankly, looking for a candidate who I thought would keep the Obama coalition together and build upon what had been accomplished in 2008. And my thinking about that and looking for a candidate led me on a journey that ended up with me becoming the candidate and running.
So you do that, and David Mitchell, then talk about your decision to help run this campaign and become a part of it, and how you actually put that together and actually tactically make a campaign out of that kind of an aspiration. And again, this is the campaign now, the primary campaign to win the nomination to run for Senate.
Well, when Ken offered me the position at the inauguration back in 2009, I was skeptical, but I was also very eager to test kind of this Obama thesis that was arising at the time, which for me was, does this moment transform the way that not just African-Americans, but white Americans and Asian-Americans view the viability of black and other minority candidates, particularly in the South? And North Carolina has never had a black U.S. senator. And so intellectually, it was exciting for me. I also have ties in North Carolina. My grandparents are from Nash County, and I spent my summers growing up here in North Carolina. When we got to North Carolina, and Al Carpenter also sees something very similar, surprise, surprise, we find that the pushback to Ron Johnson's campaign, he's the candidate in the book, the pushback is coming, it came swiftly, and it came very strongly from unique and surprising avenues. What I think we find looking back is that, part of this grand strategy concept that Ken mentioned is that you have actors who are scrambling to figure out how they're going to have a place at the table if Ron Johnson doesn't win, right? Because the idea that underlies the grand strategy is that a black person, cannot win. Right. And so if you take that as your starting point, it's on some level irrational to support an African-American candidate, even though, and this is the frustrating part, even though just 9 months before, these very same people had just been out in the streets, fighting their butts off to get this Barack Obama elected. And so this was one of the primary tensions that we felt in this campaign. Some people read this book and say, well, David's hard on certain folks. I don't think there was necessarily any animus that animated people in their decisions. I think people were just trying to figure out how do we navigate this so that when this is all said and done, right, if you presume that a black man can't win, know, we can't support this guy.
Right. It was a logic that is guided. And remember, this is a one-party system essentially down here. I mean, Jesse Helms wins at the national level, the U.S. Senate seat as a Republican. But other than that, this is a one-party seat going back to, you know, Reconstruction. So the idea that a Republican even could win doesn't enter the – so it's not a terribly competitive party. We have a certain logic here, and that's all – that's the way we think
about
it.
That's right. And I think this goes to the larger problem with the Democratic Party, and I've been saying this making the rounds, is that the Democratic Party, we saw this in 2016, they have a progressive problem, right? In 2008, Republicans famously did an autopsy, and they found they had a black and brown problem. I think if you look at what happened in 2016, the conventional wisdom was that these Bernie Sanders folks, they're upset, but they'll come back under the tent after the primary, because who would, in their right mind, vote for Donald Trump? Oh, what we found is that after decades and decades of coming around at election time and kind of talking big and delivering small, Democrats said, you know what? I don't love this Donald Trump guy, but I also don't love Hillary. I'm not going to vote for this candidate because we're being told that this is our candidate, that these are our policies. I'm going to sit this out, right? And so I've argued this in the past, and I'll continue to argue that I think that the election of Donald Trump, I wrote a piece called America Needs Donald Trump back in June, and people who didn't read the article thought I was crazy, right? My point here is that nothing big in this country, if you look back in our history, not one single big thing has been done until our backs have been completely against the wall. And so sometimes you need to get to, rock bottom before you kind of realize, okay, we have a problem here.
You decided to write a novel. Why a novel, and why not a kind of memoir or a story of this campaign that you two embarked on?
Yeah, I was a history major in college, and I was always struck by the stories. And I think that's why I really got into history. You have individuals that have the capacity, at their whim, to do things and say things that can alter the course of their particular country or world's history for decades, for centuries. And so I always felt that, I could have written this, I could have written a nonfiction and told a political story, but I don't think that would have necessarily inspired people. And I'm in the business of trying to inspire people. I think that's what we lost in 2010. When I think back to what happened in 2010, I now have a bit more of a fulsome understanding. It was complicated. People were tired. People were struggling to put food on their tables. It wasn't just that people kind of fell back from politics because they kind of drained from politics. That was part of it. But they also had, they had their lives to continue with. That being said, it was such a golden opportunity, right, to transform the Obama coalition, right, into a sustainable, progressive Democratic Party coalition. And so my goal with this book is two things. One, I want to get people angry. Right? I want to agitate. I want folks to get upset about this missed opportunity. But I also want them to be hopeful. And at the end of the book, there's a lot to be hopeful about. And so I thought that fiction is the best way to convey that.
Ken, are you hopeful? I mean, are we at a point now where we can actually embrace some of the real issues, the carceral state that we have to take on, the situation, the condition of education, of the treatment of women, African-American minorities, Latino minorities? Are we going to take those things on now seriously, or do we continue to buy into the great and wonderful story that anybody can do it and, bootstraps kind of story, which I think is part of the success of Barack Obama? Yeah.
I am hopeful. I am an optimist. But I think the whole history of human civilization shows that we do progress. I mean, that we are capable of learning from the past, and we are capable of aspiring to great things and holding great values and working to make those dreams and visions that are born from those values a reality. And so I am hopeful. I think part of the reason I'm happy to participate in this discussion around this book is I think that we did learn a lot in 2010 that I hope that our progressive friends and allies will stop and pay attention to some of these lessons.
Really? I mean, let me ask you this. Does the Democratic Party in North Carolina, has it woken up yet? Has it finally figured out that it needs to change the way it does things if it's going to be a competitive party in the state of North Carolina?
The Democratic Party is not one thing. The Democratic Party is comprised of the people in it. And so I think the people are searching now for what should be our strategy going forward. And one of the things that I am very focused on here is getting people to realize that this old grand strategy, this grand strategy of believing that our approach has to be to seek the greatest number of white voters and then convince voters of colors and other progressives to come along is the wrong strategy. And that strategy, another thing we learned, is that strategy gets implement it through what I call an operating system. And that operating system works just like your operating system on your computer or your phone. It works in the background. It produces what you see and consume. And the operating system is a connected web of consultants, high-dollar donors, early donors, opinion makers, PACs, who I believe share our values. But they are running an old program, the old strategy. And so I think I don't think they are not committed to our values and don't share our values. I think they're using the operating system to enable an old strategy. And I think what we should do is use an operating system to enable a new American strategy, which has candidates and messaging and policies that appeal to a diverse coalition of progressives and people of color who are now a majority in the United States and a majority in North Carolina, and a majority that grows every single day.
David, what would you think it might take to upgrade that operating system here in North Carolina, which is so badly out of date?
Well, you know, I was actually having lunch across the street, and the waiter, I said, you know, did you vote? You know, so I'm not really, you know, interested in politics, but I did vote. I was moved by his dispassion for the party infrastructure, the two-party system. You know, we've got to engage and restore trust. I think we saw in 2010 and again in 2016 is that there's this disconnect between kind of this corporate establishment and the party that kind of sits on high and says, okay, these are our policies, this cycle, these are your candidates, and let's go about our business. And the people are sitting back, you know, just kind of not even listening. It's a bit of inside baseball. And so, again, to what Kim was saying, you know, it's about engagement. It's about restoring trust. It's about, you know, it may sound crazy. Let's go ahead and ask people what they want, right? Let's go into communities and say, hey, I know you're hurting. You know, let's talk about it. How can we help you?
You think this is a democracy or what?
Hey, it's an oligarchy right now, currently. I mean, that's what we're doing.
Sure,
it's got to change.
One of the problems of running the old strategy is that it inhibits our ability to build real coalitions. If the old strategy is I'm going to pick these candidates that I know don't appeal to you, but then just convince you to come along and vote for them because they're better than the alternative, and then I'll just demonstrate how much I care about you through these shows of affection, or I'll come to your church, or I'll come to your community center, and I'll do these things that facially show that I care about you. That stands in the way of building real relationships that I think are needed in order to build this coalition. And one of the things that I saw in Obama's campaign that was really unique, I belong to lots of different communities. I belong to a business community. I belong to a black community. I belong to a progressive community. Yeah, I belong to a nonprofit community. And often I am moving around in these separate communities, right? They're separate from each other all too often. One of the great things about the Obama campaign is you saw people in the room together, working together in real coalition, in real culture sharing, and a sharing of cultural competency that would allow that campaign to function. That real coalition building is what we should be about. We should abandon the old strategy formed in 1965 and adopt this new strategy. And I think that our operating system, our network of donors, and our network of funders and consultants should reflect that new coalition. And I think if we do that, that's how we upgrade the operating system to win elections in the future.
I want to thank you both for being on the program. Ken Lewis, a Durham-based attorney who ran for U.S. Senate in North Carolina in 2010, and David Mitchell is the author of We Hold These Truths. Both men will speak at 7 o'clock Monday at the BU Cafe in Durham, and then 7 o'clock on Tuesday at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill. David and Ken, thank you both very much for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Just ahead, the music of jazz vocalist Candace Hoyes. Stay tuned to The State of Things.